I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the New Statesman podcast. I'm Caroline Crampton, the New Statesman's web editor, standing in for your usual host Helen Lewis because she's on holiday. She's very lucky. This week, George Eaton, who edits our politics blog The Staggers, talks to the Conservative campaigner David Skelton. I talk to the NSS science columnist Michael Brooks and our junior space correspondent Alex Hearn about the search for alien life. Our online writer Alexandreou comes in to tell us about the current situation in Greece, and Eleanor Margolis rails against the horrors of music festivals. First up, we have George's interview with David Skelton, in which they discuss his ideas to bring about a resurgence in support for the Conservatives in the north of England and among working class voters. All we can say is good luck to you, David. Over to you, George.
So, David, the new group Renewal, which you've founded, is designed to increase support for the Tories among those who live in the north, ethnic minorities, working class voters. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it is that the Tories have struggled among these groups in recent elections?
The Tories have historically struggled amongst this group of voters, but as you say, particularly in recent elections, partially because of this perception that they're still seen as the party of the rich. Partially because of the perception amongst ethnic minority communities that they didn't necessarily understand or even in some cases welcome those communities. Obviously that's changed in recent times. But there are, and also in some northern areas, the legacy of deindustrialization, the legacy of mass unemployment has meant the Tories have had a much tougher job winning votes in places like the north and the Midlands and Scotland, obviously, in recent years. But I think there are real opportunities for the Conservatives as well. If you look at the way the particularly the skilled working class vote for Labour has collapsed in recent elections, if you consider the fact that the gap between Labour's leadership and the traditional vote in policy terms is growing wider and wider, if the Conservatives can really tackle these challenges and make a lot of these groups of voters really think again about voting Conservative, there's a real opportunity for the party.
And what are the sort of policies you think could revive the Tories' fortunes?
I think there's various groups of policies which can tackle this kind of party of the rich issue and also the party of unemployment issue. The first is, I think it's probably also important to say that an awful lot of things that this government is doing are very much going down the right direction. Things like taking the poorest out of tax altogether, the pupil premium, and also the education reforms aimed at improving the life chances of the poorest are very important in terms of this kind of conservative agenda. But I would say there are a few sets of policies which can really help the Conservatives to make these groups of target voters think again about voting Conservative, make them think twice, whereas previously they might have just written off the party. The first is really being seen as a party of job creation, a party that tackles unemployment. Particularly in those parts of the country which have had a legacy of unemployment since the industrialisation of the 70s, 80s and onwards, which is why we think the kind of old solutions have failed. So there's a need for a much more radical approach to creating jobs in the northern cities, in Midlands, in Scotland. So we would devolve planning power, devolve some conditionality of a welfare powers to the great northern cities so they can be the engine of economic renaissance. As Preston, which is the third biggest job creator of any UK city over the past 10 years, have shown, if you have good transport links, if you've got a loose liberal planning laws and policy, that can be a good engine of growth. And it's also a need that you might have to look at some kind of industrial policy. The government needs to make sure that the right transport infrastructure is in place, the right digital infrastructure is in place to make sure these towns and cities can grow. And it's absolutely vital that the Conservatives are seen as the party that's created jobs, the party of job creation, and the party that is determined to tackle unemployment, which creating a negative of being associated with unemployment, being a positive of being associated with job creation. The second element is around being the party of the low paid. I think Conservatives got badly wrong before the minimum wage was introduced, when they held out against the minimum wage, and that made the party look slightly mean, look not on the side of low-income voters. It made the party look on the side just of the small businessman, not on the side of the person who works in the checkout, person who works night shift, for example. So I think the Conservative Party needs to build on taking the poorest out of tax altogether, and it needs to think about how it can do things like raise a minimum wage without impacting jobs, for example, by doing something, reducing employers' taxes at the same time. But really being seen as a party that cares about the low paid and that is aiming to raise real incomes for everybody. Third element is about being the party that stands up against vested interests, whether they're public sector trade unions who want to block necessary reform, or private sector monopolies that are seen as ripping off the consumer. It's essential that Conservatives stand up for the consumer when big business looks like they're ripping off the consumer. And it's essential the Conservatives say that private sector good, public sector bad is too simple, but competition in the private sector is what drives innovation, drives growth. And there should be much more dynamism towards making sure that competition and does help the consumer, and also providing the right kind of information for the consumer so that the consumer is empowered to act as an active consumer and to make sure that big business isn't ripping them off. Fourth element, I think, is about house building. We've got over 1 million people on the housing list. The average age of first-time buyer is now 37. If you look historically where the Conservatives have managed to broaden their appeal, house building, housing has always been a crucial part of that. Macmillan in the 50s, Thatcher in the 80s, had housing as an absolutely central part of their aspirational appeal. And I think the Conservatives need to start, say, the country needs to get building again. Conservatives need to be seen as on the side of the young people who want to get on the housing ladder, of the people who are on the waiting list, and they need to be really, really be seen as a party of house building. And there's another element as well, which is if you look at a lot of the big battleground seats the Conservatives need to win, a lot of those have an above average proportion of public sector workers and also above average proportion of trade union members. So I think it's important that the Conservatives get the rhetoric right, that yes, ministers might disagree with trade union leaders, but trade union leaders don't always or sometimes ever represent their members politically. Last week, when Ed Miliband was talking about reforming the levy, a few of the unions came out and said only about 10 or 20% of their members would subscribe to Labour if they had a choice. And that just shows that there's an opportunity there for the Conservatives to appeal to trade union members who may be Conservative by instinct, but need to see the Conservative Party who understands them, stands up for ordinary working people. And that's an important element as well, which is why we say we take the reforms to the levy even further. We give ordinary trade union members a choice about where their levy would go. They could, if they want, donate it to the Conservative Party. And that would create so much more competition and would create an incentive for the Conservatives to appeal to trade unionists as well. We found a poster from 1978 as part of this launch. The poster was why trade unionists should vote Conservative. And they actually did. More trade unions voted for Thatcher than Callaghan in 79. So this kind of agenda has worked before, and the Conservatives have broadened their appeal before. If you look at the way Disraeli broadened the appeal to working class men in the towns who'd enfranchised, if you look at Macmillan, the way he really broadened the appeal amongst working class voters, and the way Thatcher broadened the appeal with extending house ownership, extending share ownership, got a real new set of voters into the Tory coalition of voters. And that can be done again. The Tory party is constantly changed to broaden its appeal and meet with changing times. And we're saying this is what the party needs to do again.
How confident are you that some or all of these policies will be taken up by the leadership?
We're very hopeful they'll certainly be listened to. There's been a lot of enthusiasm for what we've been talking about this week as part of our launch. We're very hopeful that the people in the Conservatives understand the need to reach out to voters that the Conservatives haven't reached out to successfully at the past few elections. And we think these policies are a crucial way of doing that.
And there's some who'll say that it'll be hard for the Conservatives to shed the party of the rich image while they've got David Cameron and George Osborne as their top team. What are your thoughts?
The important thing is, for me, the big issue at the next election is going to be the cost of living. And the Conservatives have to show that they're doing something about the cost of living. So the freeze and fuel duty was such an important part of that. And we think it should be frozen or cut, if possible, over the next few years. Showing that they're standing up against big utility companies who seem to be ripping off the consumer is another element. But the crucial thing is that, not where someone went to school, is that they're seen as understanding the concerns of hard-pressed people and being on their side. And what I would say when people talk about the education of the leadership, the most successful Tory leader at winning working-class voters was Harold Macmillan, who came from a very patrician background. And you had, in 2001, you had William Hague from a pretty modest background. 2005, Michael Howard from a pretty modest background. And David Cameron was more successful at winning over working-class voters than those two leaders were. So I think it's getting the message right and making sure that people feel that Conservatives are on their side, which is much more important than the kind of issue about where people went to school and this kind of thing.
And so the 2 years out from the election, do you think that the Conservatives can gather enough support to potentially win outright next time?
I think it's absolutely possible, yes. The two key points for me are, one, that Labour does look disengaged on quite a few issues from their traditional vote on, say, welfare and immigration and the economy on Europe. And there is an opportunity there for the Conservatives to say, look, your old party has deserted you on all these issues, doesn't stand up for you anymore. And we really understand your concerns. This is why we're doing this. This is why we would do this if we had a majority. But let's not pretend it's going to be easy. Conservatives need probably to win by about 7 points to win the next election. So they do need to really focus on these key challenges that we've set out. But there is a real opportunity that Labour's detachment from its traditional supporters has given the Conservatives, if they get the message right, to, I think, yes, win an overall majority next time. And one of the important things about this campaign is not just winning marginal seats next time, but also getting in a challenging position for 2020, 2025, in those seats where Conservatives are third place now. It's important they try and get second place back at the next election so they can be seen as major challengers in those seats. Second place first was an old political mantra, and I think it's really important, because if you're second, you can be seen as the big challengers, and that's so important for campaigning.
Thanks, David.
Thank you very much.
I'm here with Michael Brooks, who's our science columnist. You'll see him every week in the front of the magazine. And Alex Hearn, who, although our economics blogger, likes also to be called junior space correspondent. And we're going to talk about the search for extraterrestrial life, which, Michael, you've written about in the magazine this week.
That's right.
And this idea that we could very soon become the only country with a government-sponsored alien hunting programme.
It's a fantastic possibility. I really like it. No country in the world touches this because it's seen as ridiculous. The only country that ever did was America, where it was perfectly respectable until sort of a couple of decades ago, when one of the senators pointed out that it was costing money and there were no little green men anywhere. And then NASA suddenly found that it was having its SETI budget cut. You know, it wasn't allowed to look for extraterrestrials anymore. And since then, of course, nobody really has bothered. And it's always been seen as a stupid thing to do, but it's not.
It's not, no. So why isn't it?
Well, it's not because, for a start, you know, Arthur C. Clarke once said, sometimes I think there's life out there in the universe, and sometimes I think we're alone. Either way, it's staggering. You know, the implications are so huge. So, you know, we might find that evolution has happened on another world. or we, you know, we might find, and we can never prove it, that we are actually alone, and that kind of makes something special out of us, which is kind of weird as
so
well.
Either way, it's a valid point of inquiry.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's really, you know, it's got to be an important question, is has evolution happened elsewhere? Is there other intelligence? You know, we know that evolution on Earth was always going to end up with intelligent life, effectively. You know, that's the kind of the route it goes down. And so if it's happened anywhere else, it should produce intelligence.
And if I think I'm right in saying that the group of scientists who are pitching for this money, it's a relatively small amount of money they want. What are they going to do with it?
Well, they want to buy time on a network of telescopes that is sort of starting up in the UK called eMerlin. And the way science works is that, you know, you get your funding for your telescopes and then you sort of outsource them, the ability to use them. So if anybody wants to kind of spend some time looking for signals on these telescopes, they have to pay for it, which is why, you know, they're looking for this £1 million a year, just to be able to kind of do a few tests, have a bit of a list and see what they can find. And it just seems like a reasonable amount of money these days.
It's £1 million, right?
It's £1 million.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be terrible if it turns out that the signals had come one of the times when someone else was using the radio telescopes to spy on China?
Well, exactly. I mean, this is the problem, is that we're, you know, real sort of needle in a haystack territory, and that occasionally we'll look. And, you know, we had this one thing in 1977 called the WOW signal, where we thought we'd found alien contact, and it never happened again. But then we have hardly been looking, so, you know.
And one of the things you mentioned, one of the theories that you mentioned in your column, is the idea that we should be broadcasting a sort of hello, we're here type signal.
Yeah, I've been in rooms with scientists where almost fights have broken out. You know, raised voices, lots of shouting, very bad tempers over this, because it's one of those things that, you know, some people say, well, the precautionary principle tells you not to do this because they might come and kill us. You know, if they find we're here, they might come and kill us.
It would be the most staggering way to go, though.
It's got to be better than global warming, surely.
Exactly. I mean, the amazing thing is just that, like you say, if we're alone, it's outrageous. But if there's something else out there, then that raises the question of why is it so rare? Why?
Yeah.
You know, it's Fermi's paradox. It's this thing of, given everything we know about the vastly different types of planets that there are, vastly different parts of the solar system, and life on ours, shouldn't there be a lot more? Mm. And you come up with some of the ideas against that.
Well, I mean, my favourite idea is that there is other civilizations out there, but they're so advanced they're going around killing all the other civilizations, which is, you know, it's called the deadly probe scenario.
It's also the plot of an Alistair Reynolds science fiction.
Yeah, well, I think all of these things have been taken up by science fiction, or started by science fiction, right?
And then there's the more dull one, isn't there, that someone's suggesting that basically wireless communications is just something that you grow out of as a civilization relatively quickly. You know, 80 years ago we were broadcasting massive lossy radio signals into the air. Now it all comes through cables, and maybe just that's a brief period.
Well, I mean everything's a brief period, because we're in this situation where we broadcast a signal from the Arecibo telescope in 1974, which was designed to be, it was like a binary digital version of, you know, here's what a man looks like, here's what a bit of DNA looks like, you know. And we fired it at a galaxy, I think it was M31, and we just fired it out there, and it won't be there for another 21,000 years.
And then how long did we fire it for?
Very much a long-term project.
So, you know, everything is so far away. You know, that will be why there's been no contact. You know, in the universe of the size that we know it is, you know, there's no reason to believe there isn't other life out there, the intelligent life out there, but it will be so far away that the chances of any contact are just negligible.
And I wanted to ask you as well about a thing that I remember from when I was a teenager, this screensaver you could download that was a sort of early
SETI at home.
Does that still go on?
I'm not sure if that's still running. I don't think it is somehow.
I wasn't convinced it was ever real. I thought it was just a kind of pretty moving graph. I didn't think it actually...
No, it was real. It was a great idea. I mean, it's a kind of, you know, one of the first sort of crowdsourcing kind of ideas. But I don't know what came of it. I don't think anybody sort of detected anything.
I think it's just that computing power is so cheap now that SETI doesn't get as... SETI can... Mm.
We should, in fact, maybe just go into a bit what SETI is. We haven't really talked about that.
So, yeah, it's the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, which is something that, you know, we've done for, you know, for decades, sort of scientifically speaking, but it's always been done by amateurs, really. I mean,
people who are in this group, they are amateurs, enthusiasts?
Well, I mean, the people who want to start this up in the UK are you know, good researchers. Mm. But the US version of SETI, ever since NASA's funding got cut, it was always done by people who were funded by philanthropists. So the Hewlett-Packard sort of people, mm. you know, the Silicon Valley types. Paul Allen of Microsoft also funded, you know, a load of telescopes. So it's sort of, it's almost been like a hobbyist kind of thing all along.
Do you think both of you were ever going to be able to treat this idea seriously scientifically, that it's ever, we're ever going to divorce it from the idea that little green men might suddenly appear and want to be friends with us?
I hope so. Whether I think so, I don't know. Mm. There's no reason why it ought not to be.
But it does, I mean, on the face, yeah. some of the things you've also written recently about this new discovery that we can now grow liver cells in mice, human liver cells. To me, that's no less extraordinary or alien.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah,
than this, you know.
I mean, I think that eventually, you know, people took it very seriously until this US senator started really taking the mickey out of the whole thing. And then it became this kind of object of ridicule. And I think that we can get back to the point where it's taken seriously. It's just one branch of science. There's, you know, there's plenty, you know, there's people who levitate frogs, you know, with magnetic fields in science as well. You know, people do strange things, but I don't think searching for aliens is among them.
Mm. Well, thanks very much for coming, Michael. Thanks very much, Alex.
You're welcome.
I'm joined by our blogger, Alex André, who has written for us on all kinds of subjects, everything from Greece to the economy to Mervyn King being a child with a dummy, to this week writing about Ed Miliband. But let's start with Greece, because I know you're about to go back over there. Can you describe for people who are totally out of the loop on what's happened in Greece what we've seen over the last year or two there?
It's basically a slip back from a developed country to a developing country. I know that sounds unfathomable, and it's something that we only thought went one way, but it turns out it doesn't. What you've seen is a huge drop in wages, up to 60% cut to pensions. Any kind of benefits have been decimated. You have youth unemployment estimates ranging anything from 15 to 25 to 30%. And a far-right wing party, which is constantly gaining ground, it seems.
So this is Golden Dawn.
Yeah, yeah,
their
Golden
sort of
Dawn.
Greeky swastika logo and their big rallies.
Yeah, 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 which they insist is not a swastika, but a sort of a play on the ancient Greek meander. But, I mean, it looks like a swastika. There's a big sort of eagle on it.
Yeah. But how much popular support does Golden Dawn have at the moment?
A lot. I mean, for me, it was a big culture shock because actually it happened because of work commitments that I hadn't been back to Greece for about 2 years until about a year and a half ago. And so I missed a whole load of stuff. And I suddenly got there, and it had been a great sort of shame to be a Golden Dawn supporter. Mm. It would be something that people whispered about in the supermarket with pity for someone else. They would say, oh, so-and-so's son is a Golden Dawn supporter. You know, it was like that. And then 2 years later, I go to Greece and it's sort of, you know, people are wearing T-shirts for it and buttons for it. And they're sort of discussing very loudly and very openly in public, you know, how's the situation with the Pakistanis in your town? And, you know, the Albanians are terrible in our town. And it had just escalated out of control within the space of a couple of years.
So you mentioned migration. Actually, how much immigration to Greece is there, and from which countries?
I mean, the problem is that there is a lot of illegal migration to Greece, and so it's impossible to estimate. There's a lot of it. The root of the discontent was legal migration from Albania. There was a point about 15 years ago when basically Greece decided to, in a controlled way, open its borders to Albanians. And that caused a lot of discontent because Greece had been an incredibly liberal society, anti-apartheid, big rallies for sort of civil rights and all of that. But it had only been so in theory because it was completely uniformly white Christian. And so it could afford to be incredibly magnanimous in matters of civil liberties. But when it actually got a real wave of immigration into the country, people started grumbling very seriously. Now, the problem with that was that physically, Albanians don't look that different from Greek people. And so language was a way to differentiate to start with. But as the years went on and Albanian children went to school in Greece, they have almost completely integrated. And it's now quite difficult, just by looking at someone, to tell whether they're Greek or Albanian. And that is, it's quite a key ingredient of discrimination, to be able to spot the subject of your discrimination. If you can't spot them, it's really very difficult to target them. And so what happened then was that there was a lot of illegal immigration from North African countries, Syria, and places like that, that are experiencing a lot of civil strife, and people are desperate to sort of leave it behind. And Greece is fairly indefensible border-wise. We're talking about, you know, 6,000 tiny islands, a huge coastline. So essentially, people would get on a fishing boat from Egypt or and just come over and find a quiet cove somewhere and moor. It's really almost impossible to control.
And talking a bit more about the kind of things that you've been writing about, what do you think are the big kind of left-wing causes at the moment that you feel that aren't being heard in the media that you want to talk about at the moment?
Well, I wrote recently about Ed Miliband's speech on the funding of political parties, Labour's relation to the unions. And I wrote partly on principle, because I think there is a huge danger in an environment which is partly fed by social media, where anyone who sticks their head above the parapet and has any kind of new idea gets smacked down really hard, and we condition our politicians in that way. And so I thought, despite, you know, the problems in the detail of what he was proposing, that what he was proposing was essentially right, and that it was quite a brave thing to do, to propose that. I was gobsmacked looking at News at 10 on the BBC that evening, absolutely gobsmacked. While the speech was going on, my timeline of journalists from all over the spectrum seemed to be in instant agreement that the announcement about MPs' second jobs and a cap on funding was really the big surprise and the big headline of the thing. By the time BBC News at 10 came round, it had been completely expunged from his speech. There wasn't a single mention of it. I actually rewound and looked again at Nick Robinson's report, and it was all about the proposals to do with the Labour's relations with the union, and there was not even a single mention that he had proposed that MPs give up second jobs and there's a cap to party funding.
But I find that really interesting. I mean, this is something that gets our columnist Mehdi Hassan very wound up, is this idea that the BBC is constantly sort of slammed by papers like the Mail and Telegraph for being institutionally left-wing.
Yeah.
And actually, they make such an effort not to be, because they're so worried about that, that then actually, that you're right, I feel that sometimes they can end up going, you know, going the other way and actually being almost institutionally right-wing, because they feel like that's the best defence against being pilloried.
No, I think there's an answer somewhere in the middle that can answer both charges, and that I don't think has been fully considered, because there was a lot of allegations of left-wing bias and EU friendly bias during the years of Labour, and now there's loads of allegations of right-wing bias. Well, the simple answer might be that the BBC is pro-state.
It is, well, whatever, an establishment bias.
Absolutely, it's an establishment bias. So if EU is deeply unpopular at a particular time, the BBC is likely to toe that line. And if we have a Tory government at the moment, they're more likely. And I think it's partly to do with a sort of culture of grey pinstripe, but it's also partly to do with, I'm sorry to say, a laziness. Essentially, government departments have a huge publicity machine at their fingertips. They can issue very detailed press releases. The easiest thing for a journalist to do is to just cut and paste.
I think we've definitely seen that with Ian Duncan Smith's, the Department of Work and Pensions statistics about the number of people who supposedly stopped claiming benefit once medical tests were introduced. And then that turned out to, you know, what's that great T-shirt? I think you'll find it's a bit more complicated than that. But then not before that was become a kind of zombie statistic that kept popping up everywhere. Before we go, one thing I want to ask you, because I think this is, I've been talking this morning about the commentariat, as it is. Your main...
Am I part of it now?
Well, this is
officially
what I want to know, is that, you know, your day job is pretending to be other people.
Yeah.
Do you feel that gives you a freedom that you would find hard to give up? Do you think that you say things that you think maybe somebody who is, you know, in that bubble, whose friends are all journalists, who is a journalist professionally, wouldn't say?
Maybe. I mean, I think it's more complicated than that.
That's how we end all the podcasts, I think.
It's just, I guess I have acquired a voice that reaches more people than it did 2 years ago when I wasn't sort of writing opinion pieces. But I neither have the skills nor the authority of a professional journalist. I think that's also fair to say. You know, I have a strong opinion about stuff.
Mm.
I have a background in economics and law that I guess allows me to be able to find my way around a document and research stuff. So I'm decent at fact getting, but I don't, you know, I'm not in a position to call someone and say, hi, this is Alex Andreu from The New Statesman.
Mm.
Can you give us your comment on X?
I guess so, my question is whether or not you would drop anybody in it by saying that the commentariat is too homogenous in all the different ways because of the way that it's constructed. And from somebody who's slightly more outside of that, do you feel that? Do you feel that you're seen very much as a kind of outsider voice?
I think... And I find myself increasingly doing it as well. There's an enormous amount of self-censorship.
That's interesting, because you don't strike me as a writer who's particularly worried about what other people think of you.
Well, yes, which is why I say that I find it occasionally, and I find it quite odd when it happens to me, and I can only multiply that times 100 for someone that, you know, writes for the print edition, you know, the editorial of a print edition publication. I can only imagine what the pressure must be on that person and how many times you start typing a sentence and end up deleting it and saying, God, I'd like to say that, I think that, but I just can't.
It's funny, isn't it? Nick Cohen says very much that you should never meet... Politicians will always be desperate to meet you, and you should never meet them, because it's so much harder to be rude about people that you've met, you know? So kind of, but he's lovely, he's got a lovely kitten, and I can't possibly... But, you know, but I think his policies are completely wrong-headed. It becomes much... I just wonder if then all this kind of everybody saying, you know, bloggers getting hated on, is there isn't actually a kind of quite a profound challenge to the commentariat from people who don't feel beholden in the same way.
They are freer to say what they like, for sure. That also makes a difference, I think, to the weight of what they say.
Mm.
I think that ease of being able to put something out there like a belch is, it also has less value than something that's been deeply thought about and researched properly. But at the same time, I do read a lot of pieces that I think there really was no reason for this to be written other than fill space. Because essentially it has nothing new to offer, it has nothing of significance to say. So, it's a sort of nice summary of what's happened in X area to date, but there are 300 of those around.
Yes, and probably on that note, I leave you with the always interesting Alex Andre. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm here with Eleanor Margolis, who writes a regular blog on our website, with a very specific beef that we want to talk about, and this is music festivals. We've had Glastonbury recently, and there's now a whole summer of them stretched out in front of us. You wrote a piece for us a while ago about why you particularly hate music festivals, but you also have a belief that everyone else does as well.
I'm convinced that anyone who claims to enjoy music festivals is peer pressured into saying that. I think it's this weird kind of self-perpetuating situation that young people have got themselves into, where we have to claim that we love doing horrible things.
Horrible things like sleeping on the ground and jumping around in the mud and paying £8 for a burger. And...
Exactly. I mean, I think that it's people think of Generation Y as hedonistic, but I'm starting to think that actually we're more masochistic. I mean, there's this definite drive towards, sort of taking pride in doing very uncomfortable, awful things and spending a lot of money on it.
That's what really sticks in my throat, is how much it costs.
It's very expensive.
I think an email from a friend this year asking me if I wanted to go to a music festival included the line, "Oh yeah, and it'll cost £200," which for me was an instant deal breaker, but people willingly surrender that and more.
Absolutely. I used to be one of them.
Hmm.
I feel like this enormous weight has been lifted now that I've come out against music festivals. Now all my friends know that I don't want to go to them.
So. But what prompted this moment for you? What made you suddenly think?
I think I've been, this summer I've been invited to a few festivals, and I gave wishy-washy, it depends on money type answers, and I think I realised I need to stop lying to these people. I need to actually admit that I would rather chew off my own hand than go to a festival ever again.
Mm.
Any festival.
And because, I mean, it's not just the personal discomfort, though, as well, is it? I mean, as bad as that is, I think there's also something to do with the actual music, because I don't know much about sound engineering, but I think I could say with full confidence that you don't get the best sound from musical instruments in the middle of a field.
Absolutely not. No, I don't know a great deal about sound engineering either, but I don't think you have to realise that listening to a band in the middle of a field, not great quality, not so
no,
good.
No, absolutely not. And you could perhaps, just putting this out there, you could perhaps pay less money and hear them better indoors.
And then go home to your bed.
Yes, that would be very, you're absolutely right, people are deluding themselves. But I'm not quite sure how it's happened. How has the country become so mass deluded about this?
I'm not sure. I think it's almost a hysteria. I think festivals just seem to get more and more popular. There are more of them. There are all these sort of new boutique-y ones coming up every year, and it's just... It's got out of hand. You know, people need to.
It's gone too far.
It's gone too far. It's.
We all need to just all at the same time count to three and say no, I didn't enjoy it either, and then we can stop.
Yeah, I think we all need to have this sort of, you know, almost like I am Spartacus moment.
Absolutely.
With festivals where we all just admit that.
It's definitely something I thought with the. The recent coverage of Glastonbury and other festivals, that the default presumption by all the presenters there is that you wish you were there too.
Yeah, I find that insulting.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thanks very much, Eleanor. We won't be seeing you at a festival this time. Today's podcast was presented by me, Caroline Crampton, with Alex Andreu, Michael Brooks, George Eaton, Alex Hearn, Eleanor Margolis, and David Skelton. It was produced by me, edited by Philip Morn, and our theme music is taken from Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. More information about how to subscribe to our podcast feed can be found at newstatesman.com/podcast. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.